I'd known we have gotten through the Hebrew definition so quickly last time, I would have gone ahead and done the Greek ones, but we'll get to those today, and then we'll begin to look at some of the more specific Bible definitions as well. Just kind of a quick review. Obviously, we're looking at marriage, divorce, and remarriage, the issue that's before us. We've gone through and looked at the modern definitions, both of marriage and now of divorce, and the modern view of divorce includes a disunion or a bond breaking of legally married people. It can be same-sex people. There are divorces among homosexually married people because the law allows for that, and divorce in our society is a legal aspect. It's the breaking of a legal marriage contract, and we could use the word covenant there. That certainly is a biblical concept. I appreciate Bob bringing that up. We'll certainly look at the idea of marriage as a covenant when we get into some more of the application phase. But it's the breaking of a legal marriage contract or covenant between two people. It involves formal and legal action. That's what a divorce is. And it results in what's supposed to be a permanent separation of legal association. The idea is they're not bound anymore by law to do the things they were bound before to do. Then we looked at some specific modern legal definitions, really the application phase. South Carolina legislature basically falls in line exactly with what we saw in the modern definitions. It's a separation of people, and it's seen in a legal way. We also saw that the Constitution doesn't provide legislation for marriage or divorce. This is a state-level issue, so each state will carry their own laws on it, but it's general across the board. The divorce, the only things that differ are the causes for divorce, and we looked at some of those last time as well. Of course, we need to remember that all of these definitions we're looking at are not the idea of the created definition. It's a reflected definition. What we're looking at is common usage. If we really want to know what the words meant at their origin, we need to see where they came from originally. And so that's why we look at the Bible to find out what does the Bible say about marriage and divorce, and especially since that is our basis for all teaching to do the Lord's will. So we began to look at generic Bible definitions. That was, we looked at some of the Old Testament, the Hebrew. We used Strong's Exhaustive Concordance, and there were really only four Hebrew words to describe divorce, divorced, and put away. And so we looked at those last time. The New Testament Greek is where we'll begin tonight. And for that, I'm using Thayer's lexicon. It's probably not as trustworthy as Vine's, though on this particular issue there's no issues, and it was the easier one for me to use this time. If you have an issue with Thayer's, talk to me about it later, and we can look and see what Vine says as well, but on this particular issue, we're not going to find any doctrinal questions. Thayer's Greek lexicon says that divorces or divorced, dismiss, and put away, there are only three Greek words that are used. By the way, Vine says the same. There's only three Greek words that are used, and we'll kind of take a look at those. Divorces or divorced, put away, dismiss, as a verb, is this word apolio, or it's actually probably apoluo. It's used 15 times. And in the New Testament, obviously, since we're dealing with the Greek here. And it means to set free, let go, dismiss, give a petitioner leave to depart. This is the word that's used to set someone free who's a prisoner. This is what's used of Barabbas and also of Christ when he's asking, who should I set free, who should I divorce to you, is the word he's using. It's just, it's got all these different connotations. Who should I separate from the bonds of prison? And give them to you. Where we see these words used the 15 times, specifically talking about divorcing and putting away, in Matthew chapter 1, verse 19, remember there's a very famous husband there, or not yet a husband in the fullest sense, who was minded to put away his wife secretly because he found her to be pregnant before they had come together. Obviously I'm talking about Joseph, and that phrase, put her away, is the phrase that's used by this Greek word apolio. It means to divorce. He is separating from her in a very legal sense. That was his plan before the Holy Spirit or the angel of God told him he shouldn't. It's the one that's used in Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32. Whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. It's used twice in the same verse there in 32. Matthew 19, when the Pharisees ask, Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? That's the word that's used, and it's used several times. And in verse 9, which is a controversial verse, it's that word that's used twice there. Matthew 19:7, the phrase "put her away" translates this word. Mark 10, in both of those cases, Mark 10:2, 11, and 12, the word divorce. Mark 10:4 is interesting because we're talking about here the result of having written the certificate of divorce. We'll look at that word in just a moment as well. Mark 10:4. I think the old King James says, they said Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and to put her away. The word in the New King James is dismiss her, sending her out. And again, we see that phrase is very common. And then in Luke, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. So that word is used the most of the Greek words that we'll see over and again. And the most common phrase that we're used to talking about with divorce, that's where that's used. The second one is just a verb. It's aphiemi is how you pronounce that, I believe. And it means to bid someone a good departure, to bid them a going away. It's a very specific verb. In fact, only one book uses it in one section of three verses. That's supposed to be 1 Corinthians 7:11. My computer put a 1 there for some reason. It's supposed to be 1 Corinthians 7:11, 12, and 13. And those three verses, as Paul is talking about separation, these are verses that we will look at in some detail. Let's go ahead and read them together and see this word as it's used there. Then later when we look at the application phase, we will study these a little more closely. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 through 13. Someone read those verses for us, and let's see this word, specific word, used several times. Who's got that? Joe, thank you.
Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. A wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe, and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him.
So, for some reason, this specific Greek word is used here. It's the word divorce in our New King James each of those times. We have the word depart, which is a completely other word. It's not one of these divorce words. It's actually just a going off of your own recognizances, actually. And that is the question here is, can the Christian leave the non-Christian or the unbeliever? And he's answering that and dealing with some of the consequences that come.
In there, which is not to depart. That's not the word we're talking about.
That's not divorce, no. It's only in 11, 12, and 13 there, that word that's specifically translated here as divorce in the New King James. But it's got these negative connotations that we're going to look at later. It's got abandon, leave destitute. That's kind of the idea that's down in here. There's a lot of other things. Forgive is sometimes used to translate forgiving or forgiving a debt. Not to hinder someone, but allow them to go their way. Here's a good one. To depart from one and leave him to himself so that all mutual claims are abandoned. We see this kind of legal language in the state laws. That's the kind of idea. There's no more claim to legality with this person. And this is what Paul is dealing with. He deals a lot with legal kind of languages in his treatises. So that's aphiemi. And then the third Greek word that we have is a very specific word as well. It's a noun, and it literally means certificate of divorce. And we see it only three times as well. And it's in Matthew 5, Matthew 19, and Mark 10, those very specific places where you have heard said of old, if a man leaves a woman, give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you, and then Matthew 19, why did Moses say to give her a certificate of divorce? And also in Mark 10, why is that the case? Well, that's the word they use. It's this word apostasy. You can see apostasy in that, a falling away from, a leaving the right course. Isn't that interesting that that's what that word actually has in it, apostasion. So that's the Greek. That's all we have to work with in the Greek, but there's a lot here. These words, repudiation, that's sometimes you see that as the word. If he repudiates his wife, that's the one they're translating. Write a bill of divorce. So what do we see with the Old Testament Hebrew and New Testament Greek word meanings? What do we see generally about the biblical view of divorce? We've seen already the modern view of divorce. What does the Bible bring to it? Well, again, we have this idea of a disunion, if you can call it that. It's a putting away of the husband, which is a possibility only in the New Testament. The Old Testament doesn't deal with the woman putting away the man. The New Testament does, because that was already something common in Roman and Greek era. It's a putting away of the husband or the wife. It involves legal and formal action. It's that written certificate of divorce, and we'll look a little more at that today. We'll look more closely at that. But there is a formalized action involved, and it's usually seen as negative. It's a desertion. It's an abandonment, and adultery is always somehow related to it. Either it needs to be adultery that causes it, or the result of it is going to be adultery. So that the sin of adultery is always involved implicitly in the divorce. So the Bible, as well as society, have a negative connotation that's put on divorce. What's amazing is even though society throws these heavy negative connotations on divorce, it's one of the most common things, and it's joked about. It's made so commonplace and so ordinary that everyone of us, I'm sure, knows somebody or has an intimate family friend or someone that has been through or has suffered because of the effects of divorce. There's not one of us in here that can't understand what that's about. That's unfortunate. That's not the way it was in biblical times. It was an extreme measure, and the majority hadn't had to deal with it. Well, what we really want to look at, though, we did all that to lay the groundwork. What we really want to look at is the application. We want to look at some specific Bible definitions. What I mean by application is, how does God's Word apply, then, these concepts of divorce, and then how can we use them to apply, and what situations in the Bible can we see where they do apply? So we'll do, again, this is kind of a generic specific. We're going to look at a couple of verses that establish the base of these things, like we did with Genesis 2 for the basis for marriage, although the word's not even used there. It is the basis. Today, we're going to look at Deuteronomy 24 in some detail to establish the basis for what the Bible teaches about divorce, and it may be somewhat shocking to you the way these verses play out. If you haven't really looked at them at all, it certainly may be shocking. But that's what we're going to look at today, and I'd like to have a reader from the New King James Version. There's a very specific reason I'm asking for that, and we'll talk about that too, because it affects greatly the study of this particular passage, what version you're using. So if someone has the New King James and would like to read for us verses 1 through 4 of thank you, Bob, of Deuteronomy 24.
When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanliness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. When she has departed from his house, and goes and becomes another man's wife. If the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies, who took her as his wife, then the former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. And you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance.
Okay. So we're looking at Deuteronomy 24. This is the basis for Old Testament regulation of divorce. And that's an important word to look at. This is a regulation of divorce. This is not, as most people say, permission. This is what the Pharisees had wrong. This is not permission for divorce. This is not an allowing of divorce. This is regulation, and I'll explain what I mean by that as we go through here, and I think it'll begin to become more obvious. So this is the basis for the regulation of divorce. The passage that we're looking at describes a when and really an if situation. The when in here is an if. If all of these things occur, or when all these things shall have occurred, then something else must happen. So when all of the when or if parts exist, the then will then apply. Does that make sense? Can you see that? It's an if-then clause. This is what's being talked about. This is not God saying, now, whenever you decide to divorce, or if I would like for you to divorce, here's the way I want you to do it. This is, if it happens that people are separated, here's the rules that apply. God does that several times in the Old Testament. He talks about what to do in the event that someone does sin, how to handle it. this type of argument is begins with what's called a prothesis. We don't have to know these words to understand what's going on here, but that's what it's called. The prothesis is the if portion of a proposition. That's a logical argument set up. So here's the if portion. I want you to notice how many ifs there are involved in this. It begins with, if a man takes a wife and marries her. That's obviously where it's got to begin. Before we can get to a divorce, there had to have been a marriage. So if a man takes a wife and marries her, verse 1 says, and if it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because of some uncleanness in her, and because of all that, and if he then writes her a certificate of divorce, because it's possible she may find uncleanness and he can overlook it. But there's another if. He writes her a certificate of divorce, and then he may decide not to give it to her. That's what had already been happening with Joseph and Mary, and then he was convinced not to give it to her, so he didn't put it in her hand. But if he does, and then if he decides, yes, I'm going to go through with this, and he sends her out of his house, and then if once she's out of his house, she goes and becomes another man's wife, and then if he also detests her, and then if he writes her a certificate of divorce, and if he puts it in her hand, and if he sends her out, or instead of just detesting her, if he should happen to die after marrying her. That's all the if portion of this proposition. The first three verses, the whole first three verses of this chapter 24 is the if portion of the argument. And it's very important to understand that. It looks real easy and simple when I've got it all put up there for you. But if you're reading a different version, you may be confused by this. And we'll look at why in just a moment. The then portion, the apodosis, don't worry about that word, is this. It's all of verse 4. If all of those things are true, ending with the man died or he sent her back out of his house, then her former husband, the guy who originally divorced her, must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. So you have the if, you have the then, and you have the consequences if the if then isn't followed. He will bring sin on the land. That's what God is warning them against. Now, the King James Version, the American Standard Version, and some of these other translation traditions, the ones who follow those traditions, have missed the prothesis apodosis relationship in this Deuteronomy 24.
Westcott and Ford.
Yes, perhaps that's why. This is something that Bob's been talking about for a while. They've missed this completely. And what they've done is they've made it look like it says something completely different than what it actually says. Here's what it says. If a man divorces his wife, and if she marries, and if she's divorced by the second husband, then the first cannot take her back. That's the simple statement of the argument. There's all the other details that led to this, but that's the main argument here. So if he divorces her, she marries somebody else, and then also gets divorced by him, the first guy cannot have her back. But here's what it looks like in some versions. It looks like it's permitting or approving of divorce or permitting and approving of a second marriage. That is not what this text is meant to do. That is not at all what this text is meant to do. The King James Version and the American Standard Version imply permission because they ignore or miss that prothesis-apodosis relationship. And let me show you what I mean. Here's the American Standard Version of the same first two verses in Deuteronomy 24. When a man taketh a wife and marrieth her, then it shall be. They put the then already here in the first verse. The only thing that has to happen is that a man has married a woman. That's the if. If that happened, then all this other stuff is a possibility or a probability in the case here. Then it shall be, if she find no favor in his eyes because he found some unseemly thing in her, that he shall write her a bill of divorce. Now, look what that sounds like. Yes. This is not if this has already happened. It's if he sees that she's unseemly, then he's going to get rid of her. He's going to divorce her. This is permission for divorce. He's going to put it in her hand and send her out of his house. And then, once she's gone, she may go and be another man's wife. Wow. That's really subtle, but it's really important. The King James Version does basically the same thing. So here's what it looks like. The permission to divorce is implied there in verse 1. If he takes his wife, then if she is not favorable in his eyes, he can just divorce her. This is the argument, by the way, that the Pharisees were making. By Jesus' day, this is where it had come to. Well, I can read in Deuteronomy 24 that if I don't like her, Moses says, you just get rid of her then. Send her out. Not at all the point of Deuteronomy 24. It looks, though, that there's permission implied. And then, this second bit, she may go and marry another man, be another man's wife. That permission to marry is implied in verse 2. How do we know that's wrong? How do we know the first part especially? The second part is a little more difficult to ascertain, but not too much more. But how do we know for a biblical fact the first part is not true?
Because what Jesus said about what Moses did.
About what Jesus said about what Moses did. What if we didn't have Jesus? How would we know in the Old Testament times? Of course, amen. There it is. That is absolutely incorrect. You can read Malachi 2:16 as the verse we had up there before we began the study today. God hates divorce. Why in the world is he going to say, if you don't like her, divorce her then? And it's over and over again that he talks about it. The whole concept of the basis of marriage. Remember back in one of our earliest marriage lessons when we were studying Genesis 2, we said, if people knew what Genesis 2:24 said, there'd never be a cause for divorce because people would only marry if they were in that commitment of one flesh. That's what it says from the beginning. That's what Jesus goes back to. So this whole concept of divorce is divorced from the concept of marriage. It doesn't belong. It's completely foreign. So we know for sure that God hates divorce. He's not going to imply that it's permitted. And the concept of marrying another man, there is nowhere in the Bible where God gives permission for second marriage. We see that he allows them. That's not the same thing as permitting them or encouraging them is the word I'm looking for when I say permitting there. He tolerates is probably a better word.
I was asking myself as I was thinking through what might come with this evening, and I asked myself the question, where in the Bible does God command divorce? And there's only one place. And that is where they had taken wives from the heathen nations around them, and he told them to put them away.
Absolutely. In Ezra and Nehemiah.
They took wives from another source.
Right. From among their own people.
They were told to put them away.
And the reason they were told to put them away isn't because they just didn't like them. It's because they broke God's law in the first place to marry them. He said, you have done what ought not to be done. You've broken the command that was given, so you undo that sin. That's exactly the point. It's not just we didn't like them.
What I really wonder if they, in God's eyes, if they had ever married the people.
We get...
They didn't have that holy blessing that he approved of. So, I've really, really been thinking about this marriage thing, is that when you get married, does God really, does he ever recognize the marriage? I mean, he can recognize that something took place, but did he marry the people involved?
Yeah, what we see, unfortunately, is that we get this kind of confusion more because of what people have done than because of what God has said. When that first person, that first licit person, I guess, is joined to you, it's God who joins you. In the case with the foreign women, he made them get divorces. He had recognized that there was a marriage. Now, that's the whole point, the whole problem being married to the foreign women is you're joined to someone who is in pagan society. You're being joined to their idols, and he said that's the problem. So God was joining them. Now, that wasn't his desire, but he did join them and made them then separate. We see, for example, when Herod says it's unlawful for when John the Baptist says it's unlawful for Herod to have his brother Philip's wife,
right.
They were joined. Philip and Herodias were joined, and then there was a marriage. Now, what we're going to look at, and that's an important question. We're going to look at this at one of the details of the application. Is the difference between the marriage and the bond? There is a difference, and that's where the problems come up. God binds you to a certain person. You can marry anybody you want, really, in man's eyes, but God will always have you bound to one. Now, I'm presuming, based on that we're talking about, when they were joined with these pagans, the bond was not there. They had the right then to marry in the proper circumstance. And I would say in the same situation today, let's suppose someone's first marriage is to someone who has no right to be married. So they divorce that from that person because the person's on their third marriage and they're a person who'd never married before. They would be in a status after having married that person and divorcing them to be married. They were never bound to anybody yet. They were married to someone who had no right to be bound to anybody. And so we'll talk about that also when we get to details. It's the difference between a marriage and a bond. And the problem is that in our language, it looks like the same thing. But biblically, they're very different. And there are some good passages, Romans 7 being the primary one, that show the difference between the two. That's a great question. We'll definitely get to that. But we know for sure that permission divorce is incorrect. This passage was treated unfairly. I think you can still get at the truth. You've got to read and study it a lot harder because of what's been done with the translation here. But you can see, I studied from the King James the first time I studied it, and I could see what was really being said, and I had to work around what the translators did, and I was so thankful when I finally got a new King James and some of the other ones that made it so much more clear. All the commentators are 100% agreed that it's the first three verses are the if and the last is the then, and they are the Greek scholars, not me. So I will take their word for it on that, and certainly all the newer translations, or all the, not all the newer translations, but all the safe, all the good translations are doing it this way. Go ahead. Yes. It's the second marriage, it's the relationship with the second husband that has made her defiled, because whether he dies or whether he divorces her, she's still defiled and cannot go back to the first husband. Most commentators see that as a precursor to what Jesus is going to explain later about cause her to commit adultery. While it's not adultery in the stonable sense in the Old Testament, it's a tolerable adultery in the Old Testament. Under the New Testament, it is absolutely condemnable. So we'll have to look at that, but the idea that she's defiled has something to do with the status she was in because of the second man she was with. I think we'll look at that a little more closely too when we look at Jesus' clarification of the law here in Deuteronomy 24.
Isn't he really warning the people of the land? He's saying, this is going to bring a sin on the land. If you allow this to happen, you're allowing sin to come upon the land, you're going to be responsible for this, not just the person who did it.
Absolutely. Look at what they suffered because of bringing sin on the land. From Genesis 6, from Genesis 3, every time they bring sin among themselves, they're the ones who suffer. The land suffers as well. But it's the people who are suffering. And this is the promised land. This is the new Eden. And he says, don't you bring sin into the new Eden.
He's not simply talking about what people might or might not do. He's talking to the nation.
Yes.
You allow this to happen, you're bringing sin on the land, and all of you are going to pay for it.
Absolutely. That's a great point. And that's the stern warning that he gives. So we've got this implied permission, but it's because they ignored what that passage is doing. At best, the passage implies a tolerance of divorce. We saw that God tolerated Abraham to marry more than one wife. Solomon certainly married plenty. David married. God tolerated. He didn't command that. He also didn't say, sure, in this case, go ahead and do it. Men chose to do it. He overlooked or winked at, as Acts chapter 17 says in the King James, at those times of ignorance. But now he commands all men everywhere to repent. Romans also says that he was able to be just and the justifier of the unjust because of what he did in shedding Jesus' blood for us, paying the price. So the idea is that he tolerated. And here, at best, we can see he will tolerate the divorce. But he wants something to be done so it'll make it harder. Also, at best, it presumes a second marriage for the woman. It was just presumed in Jewish society that a woman, unless she was just ancient, would need to be married for her sustenance. And so this presumes that as he puts her out of the house, she's going to have to find another man. And so it also implies then a tolerance of that second marriage. It does say, though, don't you go back to the former. And it puts limits. That's why I say it regulates the divorce.
Interesting at this particular one, too, that it only applies in the case of the woman being put away, marrying another, and then coming back to,
yeah,
to the first husband, that's an abomination. And nowhere else in the scripture is that reversed.
Right.
And you may say, well, boy, that's not very fair, but God's the one that sets the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, he said it one way, and you could say, well, it's necessarily implied that what goes for the goose can also go for the gander. But that's not, God didn't say it that way.
Yeah, under Jewish law, the women couldn't leave the men.
That's right.
The men had to put them out. The men had to leave the women, as it were. Yeah, Greg?
Well, and it only mentions the first husband. It doesn't mention anybody else.
There's something we're going to look at in more detail about that. Absolutely. The second husband's in here, but as a consequence of what the first husband did.
I'm talking about everybody else besides the first husband.
Like the children involved?
No, I'm
or
talking
like,
about if she didn't marry the first husband, she went and married somebody else.
Right, yes, exactly. That's interesting. She can't come back to the very first one. There's a reason for that, and we'll look at that when we look at the detail. There's a very specific Hebrew word. We studied it before when we looked at marriage. We'll see that word come up very clearly now, and it's why we laid the groundwork before. So there's a presumption of a second marriage and a tolerance of that marriage, but this is not permission. It's allowance, if you want to say permission that way. It's tolerance. But it's not saying, sure, go ahead. I'm not approving of this, is what God is saying. Now, the passage does not permit, then, divorce and a second marriage. It merely tolerates it. What we see, then, is that it really only regulates what to do after a divorce and remarriage situation has arisen. God is not saying, I want you to get divorced, so go about it this way. He's saying, if it comes down to it and it happens, Paul will do the same thing in 1 Corinthians 7. If she departs, then let her remain unmarried or reconcile. He'll give you what to do in the case that it happens. If anyone sins, then confess. He said, I'm writing this thing so you won't sin. We'll look at that in just a minute. Actually, we'll look at it right now. 1 John chapter 1, it's the same kind of situation. It's talking about the possibility that a Christian can sin. 1 John chapter 1, verse 8 through chapter 2, verse 1. Nathaniel, have you got that for us?
It says, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sin, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If we say that we have not sinned, we make him a liar, and my little children, these things I write to you, so that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous.
So he's saying, yes, you are sinners. You can't say that you don't have sin, but I'm telling you this so that you won't sin. But if you do, here's how to take care of it. You've got an advocate for that. So that's the same kind of idea. Don't divorce. Marry for one flesh for always. Marry the right people. Marry from within the Jews. If it happens, though, that there is a divorce, deal with it this way. That's all that's going on here. Really, these laws, they're in a section of the book of Deuteronomy that's dealing also with protection of slaves, protection of other property. It's done to protect the woman so that she's not thrown back and forth as a piece of property. I'm tired of her today, so I'm going to dismiss her. Now, what if I want her back? What if the next woman I get is not as good as she was? Well, I'll just take her back. Can't do that. It's really meant to deter divorce. But once these things happen, see, they knew this ahead of time, that it's going to be that much trouble, well, then don't go do it. They heard this law before they would have gotten into it. But this is saying, if they go ahead and do it, here's how you deal with it. Meant to deter divorce, and really meant to deter bringing sin and abomination on the land, as was pointed out. That's the real reason God doesn't want this done. And he tells them up front, these things will bring sin upon you, and I'll have to vomit you out like I did the people that were before you. Don't do it. So the passage really just regulates divorcees, the things that happen after people are divorced. The passage itself doesn't even give the specific reason for the divorce, and there's a specific reason for that even. It's because the nature of the divorce in question is not the focus of the passage. That's not the reason Deuteronomy 24 exists, is to show what reasons people might divorce each other for. What it's looking at is the resulting problem, the sin that comes because of divorce. That's the focus of the passage. That's why God gave us the word, was to teach people not to sin. The word, the law came because of sin, Galatians says. To teach them not to sin. There is a reason that's given. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. There's a couple of verses that will help us understand. What I said before is there's not a specific reason given. There is a reason that's given, but it's very vague, and it's intentionally vague. Chapter 24, verse 1, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her. That is really vague. Found some uncleanness in her. Many, many people have taken that to be because she's an adulteress. Well, see, that can't be, absolutely cannot be. In chapter 23, verse 14 of Deuteronomy, we see the same expression. The Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. Therefore your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. That no unclean thing is the same word or same expression that's used as some uncleanness in her. And what we learn from chapter 23, verse 14, is that whatever this unclean thing is, it turns God away from the people. The idea here is... Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
Well, if you look what you quoted there on that verse 14 of 23,
mm-hmm.
jump back up ahead of it on 12 and 13, tells you basically about the unclean thing. It's when they had to relieve themselves.
Uh-huh.
They took a shovel and they went outside the camp and they buried it, and so no unclean thing could be seen. That is what I associate with the uncleanness.
Yeah.
The bodily functions and things that God doesn't approve of.
Mm-hmm. There are lots of things similar to this that would keep you ceremonially unclean as well. Touch a dead body, or if you touch unclean animals.
God didn't allow a man to lay with a woman during her period.
Right.
Blood was a thing with God,
mm-hmm.
where it was an abomination.
Yeah, if it spattered on you or whatever.
The woman with an issue of blood,
mm-hmm.
she had it all for how many years and all that.
Right.
That may be what a man finds unclean.
Absolutely.
Something of this nature.
Even saliva, phlegm, all these different kind of things were considered bodily discharges. They were unclean. But the idea here is something that's repugnant, something that repulsed God from the midst of them, that if he finds something that repulses him in this woman, well, obviously it's not adultery. That would be repulsive, but there's a cure for that. Chapter 22 gets into very much detail about the cure for that. You stone her. If she's found to be an adulteress, if you marry her, and on your wedding night you discover she's not a virgin, you have the right to stone her. In fact, it's a command in chapter 22, verses 20 and 21. If the thing is true, the man accusing her of not being a virgin, evidences of virginity are not found for the young woman, they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel, to play the harlot in her father's house. So you shall put away the evil from among you. It is very clear. What's interesting as we look at this is that in the New Testament, we've got this idea of you put away the adulterer. Where did that come from? It's exactly what they're doing here. They're putting away the adulterer. They're stoning them to death. Now, if you caught both people in adultery in the Old Testament, you put them both away. But in this case, he's betrothed this woman, he finally marries her, and then discovers that, well, she's been an adulteress. She's been involved in fornication. And so, he then has her stoned. So, there's not this same issue in the Old Testament of putting away the adulterous person. That's taken care of. So there should be no other divorce going on, technically. There should be none other. But if it happens, then it's obviously there was something that he was repulsed by, and that's the idea here. By the time Jesus comes around, we've seen this very clearly, Matthew 19, verse 3. Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for just any reason? Because the rabbinical schools have come up with this long list of really simple things you could be repulsed by and legally then put your wife away. This was what they were teaching. And so, whether it's an honest question or not, we know in Matthew 19 it's not. They were coming to test him. But there may have been some that honestly had this question. That might be where they got the idea to test him with the question, were honest seekers who said, well, what can we put her away for, or should we put her away? So they went to test Jesus with it. He will, as we'll see in our next study, Lord willing, he'll give a rebuttal that deals with some of these things that are in here. There's some other things, though, that are important for us to see in this passage before we leave it behind. First off, is the use of this Hebrew word Baal, or Baal, which is the pagan word later, but it first was used to mean to possess, to govern, or to marry. What's fascinating is in Deuteronomy 24, the verb form is used. Verse 24:1 says, if a man takes a wife and Baal her, marries her, that's the first marriage, and that's the only time. There's other ideas of her marrying this man. It's a different word that's used. This Baal is the most used word for marriage, by the way, in the Old Testament, but it specifically refers to the possession marriage, the first, the bonded marriage. The noun form is used in verse 4 when we see her former husband who divorced her, the one she was bound to, but he put her away, he can't take her back. And that word is Baal also. Her Baal can't have her back now. Her real husband. What this shows us, really, is that possession is an aspect of the first marriage and the first husband. Already this defilement is going on in the second marriage. Obviously, this was not something that God was permitting or approving of. He was allowing it to happen. It was not the ideal. Even the words that are used indicate that, and very clearly in the Hebrew, that is not the case. The second thing, though, I think it's interesting for us to look at, and it's that we get to see the legal process of divorcement in the Old Testament, if you will. Now, whether this is a convention that is just recorded for us, or if this is what God's plan was, if there was going to be a divorcement, we do see it over and again in the Bible, the few times we get a good look at divorce. And here's the process. It begins with the writing of a bill. You write out this treatise that I'm putting you away. There has to be something formalized about it. Then you have to give it to the wife. You have to present it to her. You know, like I said before, you could write it out and then decide, well, probably better not do this. Think about how important that step would really be. Think about how important that would be for God as you're doing this, that you have opportunity to repent and stop from it. Joseph had that opportunity and was confronted by the angel, and again, he stopped. But then if you'd give it to the wife, you still have to send her out of the house. There's the three steps involved. And so after all three of those have taken place, then she's divorced from you, according to the legal terminology we see in Deuteronomy 24, what we see with Joseph, and I can't think of the other cases, but I think there's at least one other case where we see a formal divorce in the Bible. So that's what we get a look at as we look at Deuteronomy 24. So we've seen this Old Testament regulation of divorce. Next week, Lord willing, our time is up for today. Next week, we'll look at Matthew 5, Matthew 19, and Mark 10. There are some other verses in Luke 16 and some other verses that may come into play on this that we'll look at also. But what we're getting is Jesus' clarification. He really begins in Matthew 5, "You've heard it said, but I say to you." He not only makes a clarification, though, he actually changes things. And we'll see there's a new aspect that comes into play that will be established then on his death and resurrection when the New Testament comes in. But he will clarify what was meant by God at that time, and that's where their difficulties had come from. Comments or questions before we wrap it up today? Lord willing, next time then we will have a look at what Jesus says concerning divorce. Thank you very much.